You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and Pipefitters Local 533. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And Pipefitters Local 533 is a proud and diverse union specializing in many aspects of the piping industry. We are involved with and support various charities, community programs, community organizations, as well as specialized training for our veterans returning home from service. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, what's the world going to look like after the pandemic? We're going to have a roundtable panel discussion with economists and labor leaders, and we'll imagine a post-COVID future. In the news, why are so many women dropping out of the workforce? And what about a general strike if Trump is defeated and refuses to leave office? And now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, October 15th, 2020. KC tenants today, with over 150 fellow people, many of them tenants, chained themselves with the doors of the Jackson County Courthouse, blockading the entrance just before the eviction dockets began on the seventh floor. The leaders put their bodies on the line in an act of radical solidarity with tenants who are being violently forced out of their homes and onto the streets. According to KC tenants, two of their leaders were unlawfully detained by Jackson County deputy sheriffs. They are now free. At the same time, over 50 disruptors interrupted the teleconference eviction proceedings, shutting down evictions altogether across four courtrooms. Every courtroom was disrupted and at least temporarily shut down. The disruptions will continue through the afternoon. 138 tenants had eviction cases on today's docket. These actions follow nearly 5 months of evictions in Jackson County since the local eviction moratorium expired in May. Since June, Jackson County has heard evictions both in person and by remote teleconference hearings. This is the second time KC tenants has shut down evictions through disruptions. On July 30th, tenants successfully disrupted in-person and online proceedings, delaying over 100 eviction cases. KC tenants took this action again because the Jackson County Court has failed to implement a national eviction ban. On September 1st, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, issued a moratorium on evictions for rent nonpayment. In a recent report, Kansas City Eviction Project found that Jackson County landlords have filed 602-plus evictions since the CDC announcement. The courts have heard hundreds of evictions, and sheriff's deputies have physically removed tenants from their homes. Represented by the ACLU, KC Tenants is suing presiding judge David M. Byrne in federal court for his failure to implement the CDC order. Harrison Collins, a tenant facing eviction, said, I was working until March when I lost my job. I can't pay rent because I can't find work. You can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. Right now, I'm preparing to be homeless. I'm not the only one going through this. This government is screwing over millions of families.
Mike Elk in Payday Report had this intriguing story. This week, the 70,000-member Rochester AFL-CIO Labor Council became the first regional AFL-CIO body in the United States to call for a general strike if Trump does not respect the outcome of this year's election. Therefore, now be it resolved that the Rochester Labor Council, AFL-CIO, stands firmly in opposition to any effort to subvert, distort, misrepresent, or disregard the final outcome of the 2020 presidential elections, read the resolution passed by the members of the Rochester Labor Council this week. Rochester AFL-CIO President Dan Maloney, who in the fall of 2019 helped lead a six-week-long strike at General Motors in Rochester, said the council hoped the resolution would spark a national conversation. Maloney said, "We hope we encourage other labor groups and get the discussion started now about possible action strategies if Trump and his supporters do not follow the constitutional transfer of power. The voice and vote of we the people must be respected." The call for a general strike comes at a time when high strike activity levels, a result of the pandemic and the growing energy of the Black Lives Matter movement, have not been seen since the end of World War II. According to Payday Report's Strike Tracker, there have been at least 1,160 strikes since March 1st of this year.
The Hill reports, if it wasn't clear before this month's job numbers, it is now. The pandemic is turning back the clock for women. In September, more than 1.1 million workers left the labor force, meaning that they were no longer working or looking for work. A full 80% of those workers were women, with Latinas especially overrepresented. In fact, a net 2.65 million women have left the labor force since February. These numbers are unprecedented. Before this year, January 1958 held the record for women's labor force losses. In that month, 62 years ago, 550,000 women left the labor force, hundreds of thousands fewer than this September. Alternatively, if we look at labor force participation rates, 56.8% of women were in the labor force in September, compared to 59.2% in February. The current rate was last seen late in the Reagan administration. We have lost more than a generation of gains. Why are women going backward? For one reason, on the first day of school this year, about half of students were attending remotely. For parents working from home, this has meant toggling between homeschooling and Zoom meetings, stretching to do two jobs at once. But housekeepers, nurses, and grocery store cashiers can't work from home. For these workers, distance learning compounds an ongoing child care crisis as providers have closed or reduced capacity in the wake of the pandemic. Meanwhile, grandparents who might have lent a helping hand in the past are now often unavailable because of the risk of infection. As a result, many working parents are being forced to choose between a paycheck and ensuring that their kids are safe and learning each day. In the face of that terrible choice, women are the ones sacrificing jobs. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
And it's Pledge Drive, and KKFI is having its fall Pledge Drive, and you can show your support for KKFI and show your support for the Heartland Labor Forum by making a pledge. We have lots of premiums. You can find them at kkfi.org, and you can call. We have people ready to take your call at 888-931-0901. We're also going to be having a champions match, which we're going to do right at the half hour. But right now, you can still call and make your pledge. 888-931-0901.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Oh, the times, they are a-changing.
Hello, this is Joyce McCauley, and yes, the times, they are a-changing. We're going to be looking at how much they're going to change and how it's going to affect our lives after the pandemic. We'd like to welcome some guests, but first I'd also like to welcome Judy Ansel, who is my co-host. We have Duke Frum, who is the president of the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO. We also have Dr. Sarisha Naidu, who is the associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, USA. She works on issues related to environmental justice, land of dispossession, and labor and women's work. She's also involved in a higher ed labor movement and was a leader of the strike by faculty at Wright State University in Ohio a few years ago. Also joining us is Taki Manolakos, an economist and associate director of the Center for Economic Information at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. So we have some great guests, and I think we'll have some great discussions.
Yeah,
don't you, Judy?
That's right. Yeah, welcome to all of you. Let's hear your voices so our listeners can hear you. First of all, Duke, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, loud and clear. Thank you for being on. Taki?
Yes, brothers and sisters, hello, I'm here. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, and Sarisha?
Yes, here as well. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, go.
Well, we're just so happy that you could be here to help us kind of work through all this. We know that the U.S. has suffered from an economic crisis before, but this one is very different. And plans to stimulate the economy can be influenced by so many other factors. Public health officials, government agencies as they close or limit businesses, and of course we have to protect our essential workers. This time we're dealing with unpredictable factors: rate of infection, effectiveness of treatment, development of a safe and effective vaccine. So as we look at our unemployment numbers, right now we're at 7.9 nationally, but we know that those only could include the people that are able to work, ready to work, and actively looking for work. That doesn't include a whole lot of folks out there who don't have jobs. A lot of them had to stop working, as we heard in the news, to take care of children. And there are a lot of other people that are not counted in this. Some that left their jobs because of health factors and they're not looking, so they're not on that particular list. Our Kansas City area statistics are similar to the national this year. Unemployment is 3.5. It was 3.5 in March, went up to 11.3 in April, gradually sunk back down to 7.1. So it's really strange that from the marketplace, someone wrote that our unemployment numbers are kind of like a caption in a photo or a title of an article, and that's all you look at and you don't read the article. So we don't get the whole picture. So let's look deeper at the statistics. What's unemployment looking like in Kansas City for union members, Duke?
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and I appreciate that. So you're exactly right. The unemployment numbers are at best misleading. They are statistical usually, and so there's not a lot that we can be done about them. But the way that they are presented is where it gets into, being disingenuous, shall we say. So Missouri showed a drop in unemployment. So you would normally think that means more people went back to work. Truth of the matter is 1,305 more people lost their job. And so it's the reason for this is exactly what the reason the way we count. And so we don't count people who stopped looking for work. And so we do have more unemployed people. And we've got a lot of unemployed people who have been unemployed for a long time. I'll tell you just about one sector that a lot of people don't think about in organized labor. And that's our stagehands. And so the last day our stagehands work, I think, was March 11th. There was a Big 12 basketball tournament. KU was supposed to play somebody down at Sprint. And they announced that they were going to hold the game without fans and that the tournament was going to continue. And then a couple hours later, they announced they were going to cancel the tournament. And then everything else started canceling. And the next day, the stagehands in Kansas City tore down everything they put up for the tournament and that's the last day any of them worked, with the exception of a very few number of them who did some tiny minor work. So much so, almost all of them have lost their health care. And, you know, I'd heard about a prison in Asia somewhere, I don't remember where exactly. It had the most cruel punishment I've ever heard of in my life. What it was when they put you in the cell, they don't tell you what your sentence is. And so you never know if tomorrow morning you're going to be executed, if next week you're going to get let go, if you're going to be there 30 years. I mean, they take away any hope. You have no idea. There's no future. And that's what a lot of our workers are facing. So that unemployment is real. Plus, they lost health care, which is huge.
And so if they get sick, they have very little recourse. The industries, that's one of the things that I wanted to talk about, as you mentioned, the hands working in those kinds of areas. The arts, entertainment, recreation, food service, and the accommodation industries were hit really hard. And what I think we don't think about is, in the arts, it's not just the actors on stage. It's the people who, like you said, the stage hands, the folks who design the sets, the costume people. I mean, it's huge. And in these other areas, recreation, like in, if you go see a football game, it's not just the guys on the field. It's people all over that stadium making money. So right now, they're not making any money. I mean, there's very few out there, if any, that are doing that kind of job. So, go
ahead. Yeah, let me follow up a little bit. What about other union members, Duke? It looks like the construction trades are working despite the pandemic, and factories are working. What about others?
So that's a great question. So there are, so it's kind of hit and miss. And I'll tell you, I'll give you just a generalization and I'll dig a little bit, but not too deep. So the way it looks from where I sit, and it's unfortunate, but it seems to be throughout life, the better you were doing, the better you're doing now. And the worse you were doing, probably the worse you're doing now. And so if we look at a lot of the construction is going on, thank God, when we talked about the airport, we urged Kansas City to vote yes for the airport. And one of the things that organized labor said to the city council and the voters was, look, this economic expansion cannot continue unabated for more years than we can count. We've already been in a record number. There's going to be an economic downturn. And when that happens, if we do not have the job already started, there's no way people are going to vote to build an airport during that time. Now, none of us envisioned a pandemic when we said that. We thought it'd be a market correction, but it happened. But construction does seem to be continuing on. The manufacturing seems to be continuing on, especially automotives have picked up, bicycles have picked up. I mean, there's not a lot of union bicycle shops here in Kansas City, but just the national data. There's a lot going on. Anything that you do for exercise equipment, anything that is manufactured for work at home, it's gone up. Now, the ones that have suffered, again, SEIU, our Service Employees International Union, the people who man the stadiums, they're not working. You know, Sarah LaBar with Actors Equity Group, I think Broadway shut down for next year too. I think she reported that. And I'll tell you what, that's a sister. We're lucky to have her in Kansas City. But the other SEIU members who clean the buildings downtown, I mean, the office buildings at night that get cleaned downtown, they're not being used. And the people who own those buildings are saving money by not paying anybody to clean them. So it seems that our brothers and sisters most at risk and on the edge are once again taking the hit.
Okay. I want to ask Sarisha a question. Talk about the impact. We had a news story about women workers and how they've been dropping out of the workforce. Do you want to talk some more about the impact on women in particular in the workforce? And talk about it, you know, not just in the United States, but what's happening around the world?
Well, and like your, you know, the news report before also talked about this, right? One of the things that, you know, one of the problems in the U.S., as in some other countries, maybe not so much so in advanced countries in Europe and elsewhere. But in the US, what we have is that we don't have a great system of childcare and education, or you know, childcare. We don't have maternity leave, And so these were all problems that existed even before the pandemic. What the pandemic has done is intensified those problems. So as schools are no longer, or not all schools are operating, in person, we have particularly, you know, parents, but particularly women who have had to take on those care responsibilities. As childcare centers are not operating, women have had to, or mothers have had to, or grandmothers and aunts have had to take on those responsibilities. So we essentially have something called a second shift, which women, even working women, had to undertake even before the pandemic. So on average in the US, women worked 20 hours more a week on household responsibilities, including childcare, elder care, and so on. So that's equivalent of an unpaid second job, right? So you come home all tired. If you're a man, you can watch, or if you're a father or a man or whatever, you can watch TV and, you know, find ways to relax. Whereas if you have kids to take care of, or, you know, the elderly to take care of, then, you know, you have a second job at home. And this is for women who are lucky to only work one job, right? One, you know, job outside the house, right? What about women who are working two jobs? In any case, the impact has been that, you know, as kids are at home, you know, summertime was particularly hard on parents and particularly mothers. But even as schools have opened, you know, having to supervise kids, you know, education, online education, and so on. In any case, what that has done is that a lot more women are dropping out of the labor force, perhaps temporarily. But that means that we could potentially have a setback for this equity in employment rates and equity in gender or in wages. We know that even before the pandemic, women were paid only 82 cents to a dollar, and this wage gap could worsen after the pandemic when, you know, if we are all able to go back. So that has been one huge issue. We know also that for women who are working in sort of casual work, right, those who are not part of organized labor, the situation is even worse. You know, so these issues of childcare, K through 12 education, which are so, so very important for any society, not having enough resources for schools, not having enough resources for childcare, not having maternity leave, not having a paid family or family leave available to everyone, has become a huge problem. Particularly for women, and it's resulting in them not only dropping out of the workforce, but also taking on more work. In addition, we also know that a lot of the essential workers, particularly in healthcare and domestic workers, are women, and particularly women of color. So when we talk about women, we also have to talk about sort of, you know, what the racial composition or, you know, the differences across different racialized groups is. So women of color are particularly you know, affected or have been affected by the pandemic. A lot of them are essential workers, domestic workers. A lot of them are either immigrant women or, you know, American women of color. And, you know, that has been huge because for them, the choice is, you know, to either work and take on this risk of the pandemic or not work and not be able to feed their family.
It just kind of seems to get worse before. I know it's going to get worse before it gets better. And a lot of professionals and some middle class workers have been able to work virtually and have been able to hold on to their job and benefits. But of course, again, the low wage worker is not getting what they need in our society. And this economic divide seems to be getting greater. So, Taki, can you talk to us about the economic divide and if it's going to just get worse?
Yes. So, I mean, that is a very basic question in any capitalist economy, of course. Our national income is divided into two components, the income for capital or profits and the income for labor or wages. And that economic divide in the U.S., has always been very stark. I mean, as a rough guide, following World War II through the 1950s, the 1960s, and the early 1970s. It used to be the case, economists, we used to teach this in our intro classes, labor's share of national income was about two-thirds of the total. And everyone was, you know, the unions were okay with that, and the government was okay with that, and capital was okay with that. What happened in the 1970s is that that share of income that goes to labor in the form of wages started to fall very drastically. And it has continued falling from the 1970s, starting with Nixon. I mean, Nixon wasn't the only one at fault, but it started with Nixon, and it's happened through Democratic and Republican administrations. And we've really reached a situation today where it's nowhere near what it used to be. And so that's the economic divide that we face under capitalism. And it was bad even before the pandemic. And I mean, the data for assessing that post-pandemic have not yet become available and clear to us. But my own intuition is that it's not gonna get any better. My own theory about this, there's plenty of theories, is that the reason for the fall more or less is tied to the fact that union density, that is the percentage of the private and public workforce that are covered by collective bargaining agreements, has been falling and has now just reached very low levels. I won't get into the numbers. But you know, without a strong labor movement to actually enforce some type of discipline on capital, we're stuck in a situation where the labor share is very low. And I don't see any way out of that trap right now, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, Duke, could you talk to us a little bit more about union organizing? Is it on the rise? We've seen a little indication of that, but our labor laws are so weak that it's hard for the workers to organize. What do you think the future of union organizing will be?
Well, yeah. And so first, if you don't mind, I'd like to backtrack just a moment, because the other guest reminded me that of a couple of things that I should have probably said when I was talking about this. One thing is that not all of the high paid, what I'm going to consider high paid, but the ones who are paid maybe average or better than average, are doing well. I mean, we've got a lot of teachers and nurses and people, SEAU healthcare, and people who are out there on the front lines who are working, you know, firefighters and everyone else, but they're working, but that doesn't mean they're doing well, because they're at risk and they don't have that option. And it is, you know, you can work or you can stay home. If you work, you risk bringing something back to somebody who's at risk that you're taking care of. And a lot of those in healthcare and teachers are women. And so that may be causing some of those problems. As far as organizing goes, this is a great opportunity to organize. One thing for sure is that, you know, all the world now sees the value of teachers. I know they've been under attack for years. I have no idea why, but they have been attacked unjustly. And now that people are doing this themselves, they realize how important that is. We have also seen a lot of workers who now know the value of being in a union for a couple of different things. First of all, with absent a collective bargaining agreement, without an agreement, you're an at-will worker and you can be fired at any time for no reason. You have no rights. You can't complain about conditions. You have no process in place to be able to do anything. They realize now that there is help and power in being in a union. The second piece to this is that the vast majority of the people who are in a union have some form of health care that is taking care of them when they get sick. And there are a lot of people who are working who don't have that. And so we are down here at the AFL-CIO, we are fielding calls from people who say, how do I form a union? So this is a great opportunity for us.
Well, Let's hope that continues, and let's hope that they can weather the anti-union campaigns that are already surging. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask both Sarisha and Taki about academic labor and what's going on with them, because I know at UMKC there's been some major effects of COVID. But first, we're going to do some pitching. And let me bring on Jen Zaman, engineering for us.
Hi there.
I also want to thank Marlis Brandhead.
Broadhead. Yeah.
Okay. Marlis, thank you so much for your pledge to Boogie Bridge. And we need some pledges for Heartland Labor Forum because we have a $300 challenge from none other than me.
Well, so, we've already met 120 of it already.
Oh, we have?
Yep.
Oh, well, great.
By an anonymous donor.
Oh, terrific. Well, thank you, anonymous donor. Let's get some more. So, Jen.
So how many minutes do we I need to set the timer for?
Nobody told me how many minutes. Let's just say the rest of the show.
Okay, that sounds perfect, actually.
Yeah. So tell people how to pledge.
Okay, all you need to do is call 888-931-0901. We have people standing by to take your call. And or if you would like to be a stealthy donor, you can go online at kkfi.org. And the donate button is right at the top top right-hand corner. And we have some great thank you gifts this time. And they're all winter-inspired. For a $7.50 monthly donation, you'll get a KKFI gray winter cap, which is pretty cool. It's charcoal gray, like a skull cap. And you can get that for either $7.50 monthly or $90 one time.
And it's got the KKFI logo on it right in the middle.
It does.
Yeah.
Right. And then we have a KKFI long sleeve T-shirt with a really neat KKFI logo with a heart design in the middle. And that is for a $10 monthly donation or a $120 one-time donation. You can go to kkfi.org and have a look at what those look like. Or you can do a combo which is the shirt, the hat, and a guest DJ spot, which is 1 hour of you playing tunes on your favorite KKFI radio show, music show. And that is for a $20 monthly donation or a $250 one-time donation.
And let me just say, with the holidays coming up, a guest DJ, if you got a teenage kid who loves music and loves to spin music, that's a great gift.
It is.
Let him have
gift.
An hour being a radio DJ. Go on.
Well, but that's not all. You don't even have to pledge all of that. If you just have a little bit, everybody that is pledging is getting a magnet that is going to be is numbers that you can dial instead of 911 to deal with a variety of issues that you might be experiencing. And it's a very helpful magnet that you can keep right on your refrigerator. And and every donor gets a fridge magnet. So that's what we've got. So kkfi.org/donate has got all the info and more about these thank you gifts.
And make me pay, 888-931-0901. Make a pledge to KKFI and the Heartland.
You've got a $300 pledge that Judy's put down. We've gotten a little bit of it met so far, but we'd like to exceed it if we can.
Okay.
So 888-931-0901.
Okay, let's get back to the show. Joyce, who are our guests?
Oh, well, our guests are Sarashi and...
Sarisha,
I'm sorry. Let me get back to my codes here. Okay, we've got Sarisha Nadu, and we have Taki Manolakos. They're both economists from UMKC, and then we have Duke, the president of the Kansas City AFL-CIO. And
I wanted to ask Sarisha and Taki to talk some about, you know, Sarisha was a union leader at another university where she worked and is very concerned about these issues. And both Taki and Sarisha were involved in a strike of academic labor. But what's going on with academic labor, either nationwide or you want to talk about UMKC, because they're also really impacted, as well as the other people who work at our universities. Either of you.
I think Sarisha should take part of this. You want to go first?
Okay. One of the things that is happening, and you know, this is, Duke talked about K through 12. You know, our K through 12 educators were suffering, and that is, you know, suffering from loss of resources, and schools are suffering. And you know, if you can't even provide enough resources for our children, then of course, you know, it was only a matter of time before they came after higher education. And so, one of the ways in which higher education is suffering now is that resources are being cut for the notion of a broad holistic education, or what is known as a broad liberal arts education, which means that you get you get a little bit of all the different disciplines in order to be a well-rounded graduate graduate with a college degree. So that has been one of the ways in which higher education has been suffering. There's also been lots of cuts for full-time faculty, whether they are tenured or whether they are full-time instructors and lecturers. In universities where there is a union, they are sort of being being pushed in ways that have been very challenging. But in addition, in places that don't have unions, like UMKC, we are sort of facing issues of, over the summer, faculty took a pay cut. Some faculty also had to take on increased workloads. Staff were cut. We find that not sufficient resources are being allocated to things like student services. And remember that administrative staff are extremely important for faculty to do their jobs. And we know that the university runs because of administrative staff and faculty, and not necessarily because of the top administration, but increasingly at UMKC and other universities, we find that they are becoming top heavy, and that has been quite a challenge. We are facing issues of the chancellor wants the university to come up with a permanent 15% cut. The administration has been tasked with figuring out where those cuts are going to come from. And, you know, we're just worried that the academic mission may not be, necessarily, or the academic mission may be on the chopping block, whereas other sort of, non-essential aspects of the university may be preserved. And we think that that's not necessarily the best way that UMKC can serve the greater Kansas City community. As faculty, we are very, very interested in ensuring that our students get a well-rounded education that doesn't just serve the needs of today, but really cater to what the economy and society of tomorrow looks like. And so that would require not just equipping, it's not just a technical degree that we want our students to have, but a well-rounded education for them to be good citizens of the world. And we feel like that is something that administrators, top university administrators are kind of, don't seem as interested in that particular aspect of higher ed in UMKC, but elsewhere as well.
Okay, what do you think that post pandemic workforce is going to look like?
Oh, that is a very interesting question. Are you directing it to me, or
I think we should ask each of you.
Yes.
what you think the post pandemic workforce is going to look
like. Becky, why don't you go, and then I will.
Oh dear. How much time do I have? Okay.
Not much. 3 minutes. No, 2 minutes.
Okay. I'm not very optimistic. So I think essentially, we're in the middle of an economic crisis, which has been unparalleled since the Great Depression. It didn't turn out to be quite as bad as some of the initial predictions were, especially during the initial part of the lockdown. A lot of people were predicting 30% unemployment rate. That never really happened. So it still doesn't look good because with the traditional tools that economists have for dealing with mass unemployment are not very popular. I mean, running a large deficit when the economy is not very good. I mean, the Republicans did it. They did it under Reagan when they wanted to run a deficit to build up the military. And they seemed to do it when they passed the initial Recovery Act. Was it March or April? I can't remember now. But, you know, they seemed to not be too concerned with the deficit. But now in the current round, everyone's just worried about the deficit again. So unless that attitude changes, and I don't envision it changing dramatically, we're going to be stuck where we are. And the unemployment insurance system in the country is just in a totally abysmal state. It has been gutted. Again, this, lots of things started in the 70s. It has been gutted since the 70s. The workers who are covered by the UI system has become less and less over time. And the wages, which the replacement wages, the amount of money that the system gives you, which should theoretically reflect the amount that you were being paid, that also has been cut and cut. And so we keep running into economic crisis after economic crisis. And the tools that we have for dealing with those crises are totally marginalized and ignored, unfortunately.
So I will be a little more optimistic.
Okay, good. And then we'll give Duke the last word on this question.
Absolutely. And maybe it might be a good segue too. So I think one of the problems since the 1970s, you know, apart from decreasing union density, which partially was because, you know, unions were under attack, but with also the way in which businesses started to prefer not full-time workers, but, you know, part-time workers. So, you know, there was increased, you know, casualization of the workforce. And so that was another reason why organized labor started to face these challenges. And one of the challenges going forward will be this, right? Like, you know, some people celebrate it as the gig economy, the sharing economy, but essentially it's really a workforce that, you know, you're looking at a situation where you don't really have a stable job and a stable pay. You don't necessarily have healthcare and so on. But I think the point of optimism comes from the fact that even among who were previously not organized and were not necessarily full-time workers, we're beginning to see some degree of organizing even among them. You know, so for instance, the taxi workers have been kind of organizing themselves. We know that there have been some legislative gains made with respect to, shared driving, shared rides, etc. So what I see as optimistic is that during the pandemic, we began to see a lot more organizing, as Duke said. And for me, that is, you know, for people who are just entering the workforce, it's not necessarily a stable situation. And in order for them to really think about having the kind of stability that their parents and definitely their grandparents had, probably, would be to think about organizing, to sort of try and find ways to kind of level the playing field. Because right now, businesses and employers have a lot more power than workers do. And so to me, as challenging as the economic situation looks like, I think it also provides a moment for labor or organized labor to step in and organize workers who have previously not been organized or have not shown as much interest in organizing.
Okay, great. And Duke, you want to pick it up from there?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of thoughts on that real quick. So the first thing is, you know, always remember the golden rule. Those that have the gold make the rules. And so what that means is that this is going to be influenced by a lot of different things. It's going to be influenced by the virus, by a vaccine, by the presidential election. It's going to be influenced by technology, by all of those things. But it's also going to be influenced by what those in power and those with the money want. What they seem to like right now is a gig economy, where you work for you and nobody owes you anything except you owe you because you're your boss. They like virtual because there's seems to be less expenses associated with that. You don't need an office. You don't need parking spots. You don't need whatever you can do. So if it can go virtual, that saves the owners money. It also saves them money in that I don't have to give you a lunch hour. If you're at your desk at your house, schedule your own lunch hour. And if this takes you 9 hours, it takes you 9 hours, and don't ask me for any overtime. And so I think there's going to be a couple of factors in that. I think, you know, that we do have a problem. And Sarisha hit it right on the head that, you know, what happens to these kids that are graduating and coming out now in 2020? Well, I can wait a month and have fresh ones from 2021. And so maybe we lose a lot of people in this. You know, one thing, though, there is opportunity. So very, very smart young lady reminded me that in chaos, there is opportunity. And so this is the opportunity for organized labor to stand up and say, hey, look, essential workers, yeah, the people in the processing plants, the men and women who are there who make sure that America gets fed, yeah, without a doubt, they are essential. But healthcare workers are now essential. You value healthcare workers now, and we're going to say that, you know, that there are so many essential workers that we have the ability to possibly, and I'm hopeful, be able to translate and negotiate that into higher wages because those people are going to be in demand more.
Well, let me just comment that, you know, it was in the depths of the Great Depression that the modern labor movement was really born with the development of the CIO and industrial unionism. And, you know, people always think, well, you know, like if the economy's terrible, then people aren't going to organize. But I think history shows us that that's not always true and that, you know, if people have the need to organize, and if people get some hope that they can succeed, they will organize. And perhaps we're looking at a series of conditions which make that possible again. At least we can hope so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. As I've been looking at some of the information that's been in the paper and on the news and all that, I keep thinking, and Duke, you kind of talked a little bit about the idea of the virtual workforce. And I think you're right. I think it's going to have a huge effect. You know, and then as we look at the small businesses, they may not be able to function except for virtually. So do you think, and actually all of you, I'm kind of interested, do you think that small businesses are simply going to be gone except online? You know, will Amazon and the other large box stores just be taking us over?
Who wants
I'll
to
go ahead and pass that one off to the economist.
Okay, I can go first if you. So I'm not entirely sure. I think one of the things is that you know, big businesses are really not generating the kind of employment that we think they do. You know, we know that over you know, the decades, the amount of employment generated for every dollar spent or invested in a business has been declining, partly because of automation, or productivity gains, but also partly because the money that has been made in the form of profits. And Taki talked about how profits have been increasing in the U.S., even as wages have been more or less stagnant, or real wages, right, after you take into account the price level, haven't increased terribly. But we know that profits have increased tremendously. But these profits are not necessarily being invested back into the economy, right? So you have big businesses making a lot of profit, not paying a lot of wages, but not necessarily investing, you know, proportionate to the profits that they're making. And if that is the case, then Joyce, I think that, you know, people are going to try and want to find ways to make a living. Some of it could be gig work, you know, but in other cases, people might want to, you know, start new businesses, you know, small businesses. The problem, of course, is that not all small businesses stay, you know, open for very long. So there tends to be a very high rate of failure. But in any case, I know that people are going to try to at least find ways to survive and to keep going. But in addition to that, one of the things that we have seen, you know, the last few decades in small, you know, these are kind of isolated cases, but hopefully they'll garner more strength, is ways in which people are trying to go beyond the sort of the capitalist model and find ways to, you know, open cooperatives or open or worker cooperatives, you know, find ways to engage in urban farming, to feed themselves. You know, we know that during the pandemic, a lot of people came out and engaged in mutual aid, you know, helping each other out, you know, not necessarily for money, but, you know, as community members, you know, helping each other out. And so all of these different ways outside of just small businesses, ways in which, you know, we as people, you know, our goal is not necessarily to just work, right? Our goal is to keep ourselves alive, to, you know, to flourish in ways, to, you know, have good relations, to do things that we enjoy. And so we as people will probably, you know, people will be driven to continue to push in ways that don't necessarily, you know, I don't think all people will be swallowed up by big businesses.
Any comments, Aki?
Yes, can I add something to that? Let me first say that I am generally an optimistic individual. So I
would have fooled me.
But I mean, in terms of small businesses, there's two parts to this answer, I feel like. And the first part to this answer is that I feel like in the US, this is an American disease. We completely overestimate the importance of small business in the larger economy. And if you look at employment, the share of employment by small business is actually not very large. If you look at measures like value added, it's really not that big. And there's been studies that I fight with people over this. If you look at the benefits that small businesses give to their employees, just from a labor perspective, the benefits are actually worse than what you get in big business. I know this could be controversial, but the numbers do show that.
Not in this crowd, actually. It's not controversial.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah, we just know that. Yeah.
No, because so, the unionization rate in small business is very low, too.
Yes, exactly. And so the other part of this puzzle, I feel like, is that there's a strong ideological urge in the country that everyone can somehow make it. And the mechanism for that is entrepreneurship and opening your small business. Like, you can have the idea, you can be Bill Gates, you can steal Windows from Mac, and you can have the idea that will make it big. And you can open your own business and that will succeed. And the simple reality is that's for most people, that's not going to happen.
Okay. So that leads me to a real question, because you can also be like Donald Trump. And that leads me to a question for you, Duke, which is, so are you seeing that the thinking of your members, of the members of the member unions of the AFL-CIO, has changed at all in as a result of the pandemic or the last 4 years? Are you seeing any political evolution going on?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, we are seeing, I think that last election cycle, that a lot of people were supporters of President Trump, but were too embarrassed to say it, to talk about it. I think now that we're seeing a lot of people who maybe supported him in the past, maybe were vocal supporters of him early now, who are now saying, okay, this guy's an idiot. I mean, I have even had members who I know are Republicans, who I know voted for Donald Trump last time around, because they were upset that Bernie didn't get the nod. They were upset for whatever reason they were upset. They did it. They threw their vote away. They threw the country away. They gave it to this guy. And now they're saying, no. I haven't even had one say, and I quote, if the Democrats can't beat this guy now, they are done. I mean, absolutely, he has handed them this election. Everybody is looking at this guy and the stuff he's doing. So, yeah, I do think that we're starting to see some members. I also see that, you know, not that long ago, being called a Democrat was kind of an insult in a lot of circles, and not a lot of people would want to wear a t-shirt say, you know, I'm a proud Democrat. Today they are. And I even saw a yard sign, and I absolutely love this, and I'm going to plug it. They're not for sale and they're not copyright. I think you can make your own. It said, I'm voting for Biden and that woman that made Brett Kavanaugh cry.
Well, I saw a yard sign, which I can't repeat anymore, but it had a Mexican slur, cuss word, and they were going to do it to your MAGA.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway.
Nice.
Okay. We just got a contribution. Thank you. So, we're out of time. Thank you so much. This has been really interesting. And nice combination.
Thank you, and thank you, yes. And thank you, all the guests. I really appreciate it and enjoyed
thanks,
it.
Thanks, everyone.
Yes.
Okay. And
thanks, Judy. Thanks, Joyce.
Well, thank you for sharing your insights because it's just really been. I feel smarter after listening to you all talk.
Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Now, we're going to have the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. But I want to make one last pitch that you can contribute to this station and this show. And you can do so by calling 888-931-0901. And I want to thank Sarisha for her contribution. And we also have Lon. Thank you, Lon, for your contribution. And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Our calendar is posted on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. So there's some links we're going to talk about. You can find them there. Just look for Heartland Labor Forum Facebook on Facebook. So first off, until October 18th, from now until October 18th, there's a Workers Unite Film Festival going on. And the movie they're featuring right now is called Betrayal, When the Government Took Over the Teamsters Union. And you can find out about that if you go to workersunitefilmfestival.org. And they're going to be having a panel about that movie on Saturday at 2 p.m. Also on Saturday is the Wyandotte County First Saturday Democratic Breakfast, 9 a.m., also online on Zoom. I am not going to repeat the link on Zoom. You can find it at our Facebook page. The speakers are Kansas Senate Democratic Leader Anthony Hensley and the Kansas House of Representatives Democratic Leader Tom Sawyer. Refuse Fascism Rally every Saturday, 12 to 4 p.m. at Mill Creek Park, and they're going to be competing with the Women's March KC, Real Women Rally, which is also Saturday, starting at 1 p.m. at Mill Creek Park. It's to send an unmistakable message about the fierce opposition to Trump and his agenda, including his attempt to fill Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat. And we are not endorsing, we are simply reporting this event. The Missouri Poor People's Campaign is hosting a gubernatorial town hall Monday, October 19th, 7 p.m. It's on Facebook Live. And you can find it by looking for the Missouri Poor People's Campaign Facebook page. They have invited both of the Democrat and the Republican candidates for Missouri governor. We know that one of them has accepted. You can guess which one. They're also going to have a speech by Reverend William Barber. And that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. We are going to be having another candidate forum, this time about Kansas candidates, and we're going to be talking about Proposition 3 on the Missouri ballot. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Sweating for an honest wage, I'll never be ashamed.
isn't this the place to be?
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.